Welcome to Psych Pearls podcast by Psychiatric Times. With thoughtful insights into the world of psychiatry, this podcast provides timely clinical commentary and practical cutting-edge pearls for you and your practice. We hope you enjoy it. Hello, I am Paul Gleason with Psychiatric Times. Our guest today is Dr. Jonathan Alpert. He is the Dorothy and Marty Silverman Chair in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science and Professor of Psychiatry, Neuroscience, and Pediatrics at Montefiore Medical Center and Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Along with his interests in multicultural mental health, behavioral health integration, and medical ethics, he is also an expert in mood disorders. Dr. Alpert, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for your invitation. I'm delighted to join you.
June has been Men's Health Month, and of course, that includes men's mental health. Now, according to the American Psychiatric Association, women are more likely to experience depression than men. For instance, there was a study that found that the annual prevalence of major depressive disorder was 5.8% among women, 3.5% among men. So first of all, what might account for this disparity?
It's a very interesting question. And the sex difference in the prevalence of major depressive disorder between men and women is one of the most consistent findings, both in the Western world and in other parts of the world as well. And there probably are two sets of factors that make it more likely that women will have depression, and factors that make it more likely that men will either not have depression or will be less likely to report depression. Among women, the factors that might increase the prevalence of depression, we believe, are hormonal factors. That one of the very interesting and consistent observations is that the sex difference in the prevalence of depression between women and men holds between menarche and between menopause. But if you look before puberty or if you look at after menopause, the prevalence of depression between men and women is almost identical. So we think that ovarian hormones probably play a significant role, and the fluctuation in hormones across the lifespan probably play a significant role in elevating the risk of depression among women. Also among women, there are comorbid conditions like autoimmune disorders, such as multiple sclerosis or thyroid disease, and other conditions like migraine headaches that themselves are associated with a greater risk of depression. So we think that the fact that women are more likely to have those disorders may predispose them also to having a greater risk of depression. Life events and social roles are also important among women. Women are more likely to be victims of sexual assault, of domestic violence. They're also more likely to have lower economic standing and be single parents, which all add to the risk of depression. So those are factors that may make it more likely for women to be at risk for depression. For men, the expression of sadness, talking in terms of being sad or down or even overtly showing signs of depression like crying, are thought to be less culturally acceptable for many men. And so there may be some lower reporting or likelihood of reporting among men. Beyond that, we also think that the way depression gets expressed in men may be less likely to be picked up as major depressive disorder, at least according to our current diagnostic criteria, the so-called DSM-5 criteria, which is our way of making the diagnosis of major depressive disorder. Men may present with different symptoms that don't get counted as major depressive disorder.
Yeah, could we dive into those a little? What sort of symptoms might men have that even experienced clinicians might sometimes miss?
Right. So as a general rule, when women are depressed, they have what sometimes are called internalizing symptoms. They feel sad, down, they may be more withdrawn, maybe more passive or viewed as more passive, maybe more likely to be tearful, have physical symptoms like headaches or stomach aches. Men often have externalizing symptoms that are more overt, like getting into fights or being very irritable, or being more impulsive, engaging in gambling or other kinds of risk-taking behavior, and also engaging in substance use behaviors. And so those may be some of the proxies for depression that men show that women are less likely to show. But when men show those, they may not be counted toward depression. They may not be thought of as part of the diagnosis of depression.
Well, are there also, you know, psychiatric comorbidities that might tip you off to depression being a problem in male patients? You mentioned substance abuse disorder or gambling. Are there others?
Exactly. So those are precisely the kinds of things that come up. Substance use disorders as comorbid conditions, impulse control problems like gambling or like assaultive behavior or, you know, getting into physical fights, other kinds of risk taking, you know, it might be, you know, hobbies like, you know, racing or taking other kinds of risks in the context of being very depressed that may or may not have a diagnostic label to them, but still seem to be embedded within depression. So those things seem to be co-occurring with major depressive disorder much more commonly among men than among women.
Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering, you know, there are many types of depression, and I was wondering if certain types were more common among men, whether it's psychotic depression, seasonal affective disorder, or anything like that.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, two of the traditional subtypes that seem to show a sex difference are atypical depression and melancholic depression. So women are somewhat more likely to have the subtype of depression called atypical depression, which is not, the term atypical is a little bit of a misnomer because it's not that uncommon, but what it's associated with, and again, women have this more often than men, is overeating, oversleeping, carbohydrate cravings, rejection sensitivity, being exquisitely sensitive to rejection, and a feeling of heaviness in the limbs that is sometimes called leaden paralysis. That's atypical depression, more common in women. In men, melancholic depression is more common. And in melancholic depression, instead of overeating, there's undereating and weight loss. Instead of oversleeping, there's insomnia, often not being able to get to sleep, and early morning awakening, waking up and not being able to go back to sleep. There's diurnal mood variation where people feel worse in the morning and then it lifts a little bit during the day. There's something called anhedonia, which is an absence of pleasure. Rather than the kind of reactivity in atypical depression where if things are going well, somebody might be having a good time. If somebody's rejected, they may feel steeply depressed. That's atypical depression. In melancholic depression, it's more steady lack of joy, lack of pleasure in things that used to be meaningful and used to give pleasure and joy.
Yeah, you mentioned that there are kind of cultural factors that may get in the way of men seeking treatment. And I also imagine that even when men do come in for treatment, those cultural factors come in with them and they may be resistant to treatment. So what steps does one have to take to build a good therapeutic alliance? And what can you do to encourage adherence to treatment programs once you've figured them out?
So some people have joked that the GPS was the greatest invention ever for men. And you know that men traditionally have not liked asking for directions. And yeah. By the same token, you know, men have generally liked asking for help, that it seems like an admission of frailty, an admission of vulnerability, an admission of personal weakness or failure. So it's very important when men take the steps to enter into treatment or even thinking about entering into treatment to be able to help them reframe their help seeking in a more accurate way, which is to say, this is a sign of strength. This is a sign of being proactive. You are taking control. This is a way that you're saying, I'm not going to be defeated by depression or by substance use or by any other kinds of challenge, that there are resources that I'm going to make use of, that I'm going to be in control of, so that I could take my life back. And so helping men understand that seeking help is not a sign of weakness or failure, it's actually a sign of strength and of being successful and being positive. And the other is also, as we should both with women and men certainly, is respecting autonomy, that people have preferences for different kinds of starting points in treatment. Some people would like to start with exercise or diet. And if their depression is mild or moderate, that might not be an inappropriate place to start, where they might want to start with medications, or they might want to start with psychotherapy. And there may be certain kinds of talk therapy that are more appealing to them than others. And so being able to take into account somebody's preference and allow them to be in the driver's seat, especially when there are a number of different options that work quite well and sometimes equally well, but to support a person's autonomy and sense of efficacy, self-efficacy, when they're seeking treatment is really important.
Absolutely. And, you know, just building on that conversation about all of the options that are available, well, respecting their autonomy, are there psychopharmacological or psychosocial interventions that you might recommend in particular for men with depression?
So, there's been a fair amount studied on treatments and looking for sex differences in terms of how people respond to different treatments. There was a small literature that suggested that women of, especially between menarche and menopause, women of reproductive age respond better to SSRIs than to tricyclic antidepressants, the older antidepressants, and men respond better to tricyclics than SSRIs. There are two things I would say about that. One is that it's a somewhat inconsistent literature, that there were a number of studies that showed that, but not all studies were able to replicate that. Number two, in this day and age, it's a little bit of a moot point because we know we very rarely use tricyclic antidepressants, that usually the decision is between SSRIs and other equally contemporary antidepressants medications like bupropion or venlafaxine, SNRIs or NDRIs, different classes of contemporary antidepressants. So it's usually not the branch point. The same thing seems to be true with psychotherapies, that it doesn't look like there's a consistent signal that one form of psychotherapy, let's say cognitive behavior therapy, might work better than another, like interpersonal therapy or acceptance and commitment therapy. But what is important is listening to the patient and getting a sense of what kinds of things appeal to them. Some people like the idea, for example, of having reading and homework assignments in between therapy sessions and having a lot of structure. And for that person, cognitive behavior therapy might be very well suited. It gives them sort of an active role to play, even in between sessions, things to practice, skills to learn. Other people, present their depression as relating a lot to earlier childhood experiences, things that they've gone through that may have been traumatic, and they feel that they carry the scars from earlier in life. For that person, it may be important for them to have a kind of therapy that acknowledges those aspects of their life, which may be less true of, let's say, cognitive behavior therapy, and maybe more true of certain forms of psychodynamic psychotherapy. And then some people say, I just want a pill, please. I don't want to be speaking with somebody. If it doesn't work, I'm glad to consider psychotherapy, but I understand there are all of these effective antidepressants. I have friends who have done well on them. Could we start with one of those? And that may be a very reasonable starting point. And then it will be a matter of figuring out what kinds of side effects might be most worrisome or important to them. Are they worried about weight gain? Are they worried about sexual dysfunction? Do they have, medical problems that might make certain antidepressants less safe for them? And so even there would be some individual variation in the treatments we choose, not so much because they're men, but because of their individual histories and their own personal concerns.
Yeah. I mean, just speaking of side effects in general for a moment, do those tend to differ by sex as well?
The way in which they're expressed, in general, they're very equivalent, but when it comes to, for example, sexual side effects, for men, often sexual side effects that are more prominent in general on serotonergic medications, which are most of the antidepressants, have fairly prominent serotonin effects, tend to be delayed ejaculation and less sensitivity during sexual intercourse. For women, it may be diminished sensation as well, diminished lubrication, sometimes lowering libido. So they might manifest a little bit differently, just because sexual behavior is a little bit different for the for men and women. Other side effects like insomnia, nausea, weight gain are fairly similar between men and women. But again, for the individual, one of those side effects may be more of a worry than one of the others. So we might choose the antidepressant based on that person's preference.
Yeah. So once we've, you know, established a therapeutic alliance and we've worked together to build a treatment plan, I'm kind of wondering about the prognosis. Is the prognosis for men with depression or other mood disorders different than it is to women?
In general, the prognosis is very, very similar, that with either concerted antidepressant treatment or psychotherapy treatment, most men respond to treatment and get better. Most women respond to treatment. However, many people and possibly the majority of people need to try more than one treatment before we arrive at treatment that works fully for them. So for example, if we look at remission rates on a given antidepressant, and by remission, I mean somebody goes from being fully depressed to being fully asymptomatic, really back to themselves. Only about a third of people on a given antidepressant will remit with that antidepressant alone. About half of them will respond, which means they are noticeably better, but only half will reach full remission where they're asymptomatic, where they're fully back to themselves. And so often we need to be creative, that we might add psychotherapy to an antidepressant. We might combine two antidepressants together. We might switch to a different antidepressant. For very severe depressions, we might think about neurostimulation like electroconvulsive therapy. But in general, men and women respond equally well to those more severe treatments like electroconvulsive therapy, as well as to less invasive treatments like psychotherapy.
Now, stepping back for a moment, you know, you had a long career researching and treating mood disorders. What are some of the major ways that psychiatry's understanding of men's mental health has changed over time?
Well, I think one, and this may be as much a societal progress as psychiatric progress, is that our understanding is a little bit more nuanced, that, you know, we understand that the stereotype of the macho male who doesn't want to talk about their feelings or is unwilling to accept help is it's a generalization, and it's a generalization for a reason, because there are many men who feel that way. But there are other men who increasingly understand that conditions like major depressive disorder are part of the human condition and that they're in good company. And fortunately, athletes and other prominent leaders have come forward and talked about their own depressions. And it's become increasingly clear to men as to women that depression is one of the conditions that few families are not touched by, that it's very rare not to find that you yourself or somebody in your family or your college roommate or your boss, people that you look up to, have at one point or another in their life struggled with depression, and hopefully now we're doing better. I think that that's something we've learned, that not to assume that for everybody, depression, talking about depression is off the table or asking for help is off the table. But we do understand that we still do need to make a special effort to reach out to many men, and that it still is a little bit more of a hurdle for many men than it might be for others.
And if it's now at least more accepted to sort of come in for treatment, what are your hopes for the treatment of mood disorders in the future, in men or otherwise? You know, where are we going to be in 10 to 20 years?
So we still have a lot to figure out about the true causes of depression, that, you know, we have a syndrome that we call major depressive disorder or clinical depression. It's a syndrome the way fever and sore throat might be a syndrome, but, you know, fever and sore throat we know could be caused by a virus, a bacteria, it could be a specific bacteria like strep. We think that major depressive disorder may well be multiple different underlying conditions, but expressed in, you know, in the same way, you know, with 5 out of 9 symptoms that we define, you know, as clinical depression or major depressive disorder. So understanding more about the different kinds of underpinnings of depression and the risk factors that might be different for those different forms. And through that, also understanding what treatments connect best with which forms of depression. As I said, right now, we're flying a little bit blindly. I mean, we're thoughtful. We try to be thoughtful in our prescribing and our prescribing both of medications, neurostimulation, psychotherapies. But we don't have a way of saying, oh, for this particular underlying form of depression, this particular kind of treatment is going to be most effective. And that's why when we start off, we have about a 1/3 of a chance that whatever we try will help that person remit fully, that we often need to go on to thoughtful trial and error. Hopefully over the next 10 to 15 years, as we learn a little bit more about the underpinnings of depression, we'll also learn a little bit more about how to connect that particular depression with the many different forms of treatment that we now have.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and given what a large and multifaceted problem depression is, still, what's one piece of advice that you'd love to give your colleagues related to depression or other mood disorders? One thing that can really help them get started treating it well?
I think taking into account people's preferences, that we're so fortunate to have an expanding range of evidence-based treatments that are safe and effective. They're not nearly as effective as we wish, as I was saying, but they are often effective. And so being able to respect somebody's interests and preferences as a first step, and then always persevering, always continuing, because we know that that first step is often not sufficient, and we're going to have to take a second step and sometimes a third and fourth and fifth step, and sticking with it with that person, but always paying attention to that person's preferences, because it's really a partnership. If you want that person to stay with treatment, it really needs to be viewed as a collaboration and a partnership in helping that person get as better as possible and back as back to themselves as we can.
Right. It sounds like with all of our scientific advances and everything we hope to learn in the next 20 years, it does start from the doctor-patient relationship, building that alliance.
It absolutely does.
And that's all the time we have for today. So thank you again, Dr. Alpert.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.